La 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 la. Ooh la la la. Ooh la la la.
If you want to hear your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. They talk megabytes to petabytes and cover it all. They're the Gizmo.
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 108. I'm Chris, and with me as always is Matt.
Hey!
And today we're talking about the debates, which was an interesting occurrence. It was the greatest show on earth. I wish Barnum and Bailey had been the moderators. but for presidential debates, by far it was as entertaining, if not more, than when Ross Perot said chicken feathers to Bill Clinton.
I have to admit, I didn't watch it, but being a Politico, I'm aware of it.
Lots of controversy in this one, though, as we were talking off air. What do you think?
You know, yes and no. Do I think... So, I mean, if you watch the debates, I don't think anybody in their right mind cannot think that it was the Lester Holt, or whatever his name is, who was the moderator, and what was it on, ABC or NBC? Whoever it was on, definitely part of the left-leaning media. I thought a couple things. I thought Bill Clinton, although not the most, or Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, not the most eloquent person in the room, didn't hurt himself any, and probably helped himself quite a bit. His platform, what he talked about was he stayed true to what he's been saying all along. On the flip side, I think Hillary, she is a political animal. That's all she is. You can't say she's anything else. She spoke like a politician. One of the things I do believe that she did well, because I think if Richard Nixon had done this, or Gary Hart, or anybody else, is somebody finally had the balls to say, I made a mistake, regarding the email scandal. She did. She should be in jail for it, because anybody else would if they had passed classified information on unclassified systems, they at least would have been barred from ever having do any government service, working for the government, and holding a clearance ever again. But being the Clintons, I guess you get a get out of jail free card there.
Yes, when you're running for president, you can do whatever you want to do.
But that's a whole other discussion. I think Matt and I talked about last time when I said that. If they let her go, then they need to give Snowden immunity and Petraeus and.
And I've heard of at least two cases of active duty military personnel who have been prosecuted for far less.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Than what she's gotten away with.
But... The funny thing is now the controversies over this, and I'm actually I don't like watching the debates. I usually read about it later and watch little clips of when they make the bombastic statements and the retorts and stuff like that. But I don't watch the whole debate. And I actually watched the whole debate. My wife and son had it streaming, and then I had it on the over the air television in the family room, and sat on the couch and watched it. I didn't even have my phone or my laptop up, which is odd.
Wow.
And I'm actually awaiting the next debate, because I want to see, it's going to be different topics. I want to see how they react and stuff. But, it is funny, speaking of controversy, so there's all these, there's a couple. Well, one, they say that Hillary had a teleprompter in her podium. Another, said she had an earpiece, and another said she was giving Lester Holt hand signals. I think the hand signal thing is possibly true. I think that there could have been collusion there, and she was giving hand signals, you know, scratching under her eye, because she does it too many times. And it's not... It didn't look natural.
Nothing she does looks natural. She's a Cylon.
No, she's not. They were much better looking.
See, I figure there's a... there has to be a female equivalent of... I forget his name, but... The guy from Quantum Leap, who was the religious guy, Cylon.
Oh, Dean's...
yeah, Dean Stockwell.
Yeah.
All this has happened before, and it'll happen again.
It will. We don't seem to learn from our mistakes.
No, we don't.
But, and I think probably the most controversial thing that Trump said was, and so... Should he have made the statement? Probably not the way he made it. But I have respect for him when he says, and people are going to go, what? I have respect for him when he says, I'm pretty smart. I didn't pay any federal tax. So here's the thing. He's not doing anything illegal. He's using deductions and loopholes in the tax laws as they exist, which are legal to use, that everybody should be able to use and can. So... My big thing, Matt and I were talking before we got on air, and I said, you know, nobody, if people want to complain about him doing something...
That's perfectly legal.
It's perfectly legal, and what he should be doing, and what, as a business leader, every business leader is doing. I mean, look at what other companies do. You look at Apple and Microsoft, and they are parking money outside of the country because they have large cash reserves that if they brought it into the United States, who, by the way, we're a capitalist country and we tax more business taxes than our socialist brethren, give everything away. And everybody's crying foul about that. Well, they're doing what their responsibility to their stockholders and their employees and everything to keep the company profitable and running and keeping jobs. And, you know, so my statement to everybody else is, well, you know, if you're unhappy with that, those things, one, you change the law to close those loopholes, but two, don't ever take a deduction on your federal income taxes again, ever. Because you're doing the same thing. And I know people will cry foul and everything else, but he makes so much more money than we do. Everything else, but it's the same. He earned it too.
Well, and that's just it.
He worked for it.
He risks it too.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So.
If he lost it all, there wouldn't be any crying, oh, we should give him back his money.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and they brought up his bankruptcies as well, and unfortunately, that is a... You know, from a business perspective, that happens, and you have to write a business off. That's why we use the term, writing it off. And a lot of that starts with Chapter 11 or Chapter 13, bankruptcy, you know, for a business. So, again, if you don't... what's good for the goose, I guess, is not good for the gander, is what they're saying.
Well, it never is. I mean, this comes back to classism.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it's really about for a lot of these people. It's that they're jealous of what he has and has.
Well, that's the whole. That's the whole thing of a redistribution of wealth.
Sure.
You know. Because it's, I don't know. I think we might have said this before. So the reality of it is, the terms liberal and conservative that we use today are not correct. Liberal, L-I-B, the prefix, which is also the same word as liberty, or prefix for liberty, those people believe, or the classical liberals who founded our country, believed in as little government as possible, and the only regulation should deal with individuals interfering with each other's liberty. So, you know, if you kill someone, you're causing them, somebody, not to be able to earn money and earn a living and, you know, work hard and do what they want. Conservatism, or the classical conservatism, are more people who are like the National Socialist Democratic Party that started in Germany late 20s and through World War II. We're going to education for all, but, you know, you can only learn these things, and manufacturing jobs for everyone, but you're only, you know, subsisting on the rations that you're given. That's conservatism, and the redistribution of wealth is conservatism or classical conservatism. And I think it's a shame that people don't know the language well enough to really understand that. And I think that's why we see the dramatic shift. You know, the South for decades and decades and decades was largely a what we used to call a Democrat or liberal area. But the reality is their values are still the same. It's just the parties have switched their platforms on who's actually for liberty and who is not. And I would argue that there's a lot of Democratic presidents that we've had in the past who in reality were conservatives posing as Democrats, like FDR.
Well, I keep saying that if JFK were running today, he'd have been a Republican.
Oh, absolutely. The problem is he'd be like Gary Hart. Okay, so enough about the debate. iPhone 7 came out, and they released updates for Mac OS X and iOS 7, which, the iPhone 7 is arguably, it doesn't matter if it's the iPhone 7 or the Samsung Galaxy Note or whatever, the hardware, it's becoming incremental upgrades. You know, newer processors are out, so we're going to put the faster processor in. Newer cameras are out, so we're going to do the newer camera. Because hardware, and even on the phone level, as expensive it is, and it's same thing with x86 processors. A lot of it's about the software that runs on. And so I wasn't that excited about the iPhone 7, but I was very excited about macOS 10 Sierra and iOS 7 because the integration and the ecosystem is just phenomenal in those products. I mean, I can go to my computer and I can tell it to turn my phone's hotspot on and turn it off when I'm done using it. My computers, because I use two laptops and a desktop, all my files are sunk across them automatically, even on the desktop. So it used to be that if I didn't put it in a certain folder, it didn't get sunk across. Now my documents and my desktop gets sunk across all my machines. So if I leave a document on one and it's connected to the internet, when I pull up my laptop out in the field and I connect it to the internet, my documents on my desktop and stuff are there. And that is a killer app, just alone by itself. You know, and the fact that I can wirelessly transfer files between my phone and my iPad and my computers without having to go through a special, you know, I just go to AirDrop and the other things show up and they're already authenticated and I can just drag files and stuff back and forth. And even to other people, you know, the ecosystem is just really, 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 really good. And I don't think anybody has as good an ecosystem. Microsoft's trying. Windows, I thought Windows 8 was a setback and they had actually made some progress with 8.1. I still struggle with Windows 10. I finally got my Surface Pro, which is the only Windows box that I use. It was having issues where it wouldn't update correctly and it wouldn't connect to the internet. And I finally got all of that straightened out. I had to basically do a rollback and then reapply patches that screwed it up. And they have the Windows Phone and it will do some of those things from an ecosystem standpoint, but not enough. You know, I always feel that if I'm using my Windows stuff, that you know, I'm set back 5 years in being, you know, in productivity. The other thing that I find amazing, and I know people are gonna, they're gonna look at me strange, but there's a lot less software available for Windows than there used to be.
Well, I think part of that is Windows 10 is still so new. Microsoft is really the only software giant that's really doing anything for it.
I mean, you know, their software pack, one, they switched to their software store. And unfortunately, the Microsoft software store, it has some good titles in it, but they didn't put Office in there, like your Office 365 subscription. They ought to, and that's another one they should do for Apple, too. They make it for Mac OS X, and they're going to continue to support it because that's a profitable area. Office 365 ought to be in the Mac App Store, and you just pay for your subscription there. Get over the fact that you're going to pay them 10% or whatever. Because you put Office, all the Office apps in the iOS store, and you pay for it for them, and you pay for it with Google and Android. And but they didn't even put it in their own store. You still have to go out to the Office website, you know, Office 365 website, pay your subscription, download it, install it as a normal app. And there's other apps like that too. I mean, don't get me wrong, you know, you have all the Adobe products, but they're so cross-platform, there's no reason. And I'm kind of a Microsoft purist on my Microsoft devices. Unless it's in their app store or it is a Microsoft app, I don't tend to install it. I won't even put iTunes on Windows because not that iTunes is a bad product, you know, the Windows product is flawed or anything else, but I think a lot of Windows app developers are having a hard time making sure their applications continue to run as Microsoft patches. I mean, look at Steam. Microsoft is intentionally stopping Steam from being installed on Windows 10 devices through patches. Every time they patch, Steam breaks.
It's true.
You know?
I'm a little less sensitive to that right now because I'm, as you know, in the process of moving, so I'm not as connected as I normally am.
Yeah.
So I'm not quite as up on that, but I do recall Steam having to do yet another update every time I turn my machine on.
It's such a big deal that my son just turned his Windows gaming machine off and won't play it anymore, and just started gaming on his MacBook Pro.
That's horrible.
Yeah.
That's seriously a problem.
Because he would spend hours backing patches out to see which one broke Steam so he could then update Steam and then put the patch back on, which would make Steam work again. Wow. You know, like...
That's one of the things that makes dealing with Microsoft aggravating.
Very much so. Very much so. But, you know, you would think that Microsoft has a different ecosystem than Apple. You know, Apple has, you have the iPhone, iPad, so you have, you know, mobile device or phone, tablet, and then you have the Mac. So, and then, you know, which are, you have desktop Macs and laptop Macs. Most people, and more people than you think, will have a desktop and a laptop and an iPad and iPhone.
Sure.
But they've got this incredible ecosystem that works together. Like one of the things I just got into because they had really improved it in iOS 7 was HomeKit. So I have a couple of the iHome smart home plugs. And so I can tell Siri on my phone, turn on the couch light, and it'll turn on the light beside the couch, or turn on all the lights, and it'll turn on all the lights that we have those plugs on. Or turn them off, and I can do it remotely. But it works every time. I used to use X10 years ago. You know, almost people forget how long ago the X10 has been around. And you had to have a special radio that hooked to your computer that then broadcast the commands out to the different devices. And it would be hit or miss whether it worked or not. You know, and so you'd have to go reset. And you had to make sure that every one of the plugs you put in the wall was on a separate channel and that you had that channel correctly identified in the software. I mean, it was a lot of configuration. Once you get it all working, it worked relatively well. But like I said, you have issues where, you know, one oddball would not consistently turn on or off at the end of the network or whatever. But this really works well, because it, and largely in part, I think it's just because Wi-Fi is now so pervasive and people understand it, that these things, you know, now...
Well, the other part of that, though, is I think so many of these peripherals, for lack of a correct word, are self-configurable.
Yes, yes.
Yeah,
well, it's part of that Internet of Things thing.
Well, yeah.
But, you know, but I mean, there's just simple things that, like I was saying before, you know, like my laptops or my desktop can turn the personal hotspot on my phone on from there through the Wi-Fi menu, and then when I'm done with it, it'll turn it off. And it'll turn it off when, like, the computers go to sleep. And one of the other things, so, like, the Apple TV, you know, and Apple's got a lot more competitive with the pricing on it, but it does something really unique. If you have an Apple device, I can, say in a business environment, I need to do a presentation on the screen. Well, because that's connected to the Wi-Fi network, I can pick it as an output device for my presentation or as an output device for my laptop. I can show you my desktop, I can show you any app I'm using, but it's seamless. It shows up because it's there, and the Bonjour networking, which is that zero config network that they've adopted, works really well and really reliably. Windows has that capability, and I have the Microsoft display stick. Well, that stick has issues. One, you connect to it via Wi-Fi. So, like, because I've used it in hotels before, you know, want to watch something on my laptop on the screen in the hotel. But I wanted to surf on my laptop while it was playing that thing. Well, when my laptop connects to it to broadcast and then tries to connect to a Wi-Fi network, I get all these disconnects. And then... Because I'm not entirely sure what this issue is, but there's some kind of latency issue. So if you're doing multiple things on that device, which I never have a problem with my iPad, and it's broadcasting to the TV, and I'm playing a game while it's showing a YouTube video, you know the video will stutter along. But if I'm looking at it on my tablet or my Surface Pro, it's running fine. And I think a lot of that is they don't quite have the networking thing figured out. The other thing is, there's very little Xbox integration. You have the Xbox app, the Xbox Glass, or where's the rest of the, you know, you know, why can't I open something and wirelessly display it on the Xbox? Because you're talking about, it's another computer.
But the thing is that in the Apple world, that's not even, I mean, that's how they think of it.
Yeah.
I think in the Microsoft world, it's...
It's islands in the sand.
It is. It's each product is its own, and its own territory, and there's very little interaction between those islands other than what they absolutely have to do.
Here's another, you know, great idea. So Microsoft had one thing I really like on my Surface is the login via picture. Uh-huh. I think that's pretty cool. And I use that as opposed to putting my password in every time. Apple went another step with that whole integration. So, you know, Apple Watch, I find it extremely useful. But they extended that. You know, most people would just find it more of a novelty, you know. And I think that's the problem with smartwatches in general. In many respects, a lot of what you do on them is a novelty. But Apple took it another step. So now... If I'm wearing my watch, which makes you authenticate when you put it on, and my laptop's asleep, and I go and hit the space bar to wake it up, it will unlock my laptop based on the proximity of my Apple Watch. Now, if my Apple Watch can't unlock it, it then gives me the password prompt to unlock it. You know?
Well, and to me, that's cross-platform integration, and that's, you know.
But... That actually makes you more productive.
Sure, and I think that's one of the things that makes... Apple's been on that route for a while.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think Microsoft is still pretty old school when it comes to stuff like that. They're not quite as nimble. they don't think that way.
Yeah, it strikes me as odd because usually they're quick on the uptake to be the copycat. You know, we didn't think of it, but heck, we're gonna add it to our stuff. You know, and. Now, I will say this. Microsoft's gotten a lot better in different ways, and you can definitely feel the company is different under Nadella's leadership versus Bill Gates or Steve Ballmer. You know, because with Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer, if it was not invented here, then it wasn't good. And I think Nadella's much more pragmatic and realizes that there's lots of good things going on at other tech companies. And they need to get on board and, you know, so like the proliferation of even though in the beginning it was forced, but the proliferation of Office across platforms. I mean, if Microsoft really wanted the trifecta and to take extra market share, they would do Microsoft Office 365 as an actual binary. It's just like for Mac and PC for Ubuntu and Red Hat Linux. You know, so you have a Debian and a RPM-based installer with the actual apps. Because there are a lot of businesses who are, you know, who have the expertise to do self-support and use a lot of this open-source stuff. And if you added Office to it, it would just be the perfect trifecta. Even though there's LibreOffice and all that out there... those, in some respect, are much slower to change because... they're more being open source. Changes don't get applied as quickly because they have to be validated and verified, and you know. And there's a sensitivity now in open source to make sure that there's no backdoor code that's being contributed and everything else. And you know, so there's that. In one way, open source is a little more stagnated than the tech companies can be.
Right.
And I would just think that would just be a killer app because Adobe's looking at it, you know, and AutoCAD, Autodesk has been, you know, using Linux as a platform.
Well, I think the difference between CAD and Adobe and Microsoft is, you know, PDF has become a standard.
Yeah.
Across all platforms, but when you have to be that generic. Your approach is very different.
Oh yeah.
Than say Microsoft, who own the platform.
Well, the thing is they already have the basis to get it done. You have Mac OS X, which is a Unix. You have the Android version, which is Linux, and you have the iOS version, which is Unix. So, you know, the other thing, you know, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but. Microsoft has made SQL Server available for Linux.
Oh, really?
You know, MS SQL.
Wow.
Which is, that's a big step. Because there's some really cool things that you can do in Microsoft SQL that you can't typically do in your open source databases. And it's heck of a lot, you know, from a supportability perspective, it's a heck of a lot cheaper than Oracle. Or SAP, if you have one. Although SAP gives HANA away for free.
But you know, one of the things that I think I find from a, you know, I view technology through the prism of politics. I think it's interesting that what you have been advocating, which is Microsoft essentially doing what Apple's doing, how that would really work would be like Coke and Pepsi. I mean, it's...
Yeah. Well, the downside ecosystems is this, and I know that, you know, there's some...
But you know, I like RC Cola.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You know, I like that Samsung can make a phone. You know, and if it were just Apple and Microsoft that was in that market and that was it, I think that would stunt the innovation.
Well, my thing is this, is I don't want Microsoft to become interoperable from Apple. I understand the issue. You know, you have an ecosystem, you pick it because it's the integration that matters.
Sure.
And we've not had in technology, we've not had a successful integration over standards. Just, it doesn't work. Let's look at SNIA. Yeah, we have engineering standards and IEEE standards for signaling interfaces and things like that, but that's different than, like,
technology and operability to where, you know, things work together.
It takes, those things are very, very, very slow moving, and that's why, you know, 20 years ago when X10 was created, it hasn't gotten any farther than it is today. And I do see interoperability happening, and like those iHome devices can also work with Android, you know, with no issue. They have that integration already built in. It's not quite the same because it's done from an Android perspective as opposed to an Apple perspective. But my thing is I think Apple's on the right track for, so like they have the iHome standard. So if your device, you're going to build it and you want it to work with Apple equipment, here's our API and our programming kit, and you support that. And that's the way Android has gone as well. Microsoft hasn't been doing any of that. So you have these, you have vendors who support interoperability with their device and Windows, but my thing with, like, and I'm going to use HomeKit again because that's one where the manufacturers of all the HomeKit devices are, you know, there's 20 or 30 of them, and all of them also support Android. And why? Because there's APIs and standards that they can follow to make sure that the code on their devices will comply with how it works. Microsoft, it's like you have to build it all from scratch. And there are some APIs and stuff there, but they're not super well defined, and they don't address these things in the market. Because the thing is, as we move forward with the Internet of Things, which unfortunately, regardless of the privacy issues and all that I foresee having being an issue, they don't have any standards for manufacturers to be able to design products around.
Yeah.
Like, good example, Samsung. They provide a very, very well-documented API for their smart refrigerators that have little TVs in them, and has a camera inside the door, and it takes pictures of everything in the refrigerator, and notices if there's anything in the culture that you're out there, and you'll go by mobile. That has full integration with both macOS and iOS and Android right out of the box, because they built APIs, they programmed to their own APIs, and then they provided those APIs to other people to integrate it with their operating systems and or products. But, you know, other than getting email alerts, which is a standard, SMTP, where's my integration with Microsoft, where, you know, it gave me a pop-up that said, hey, you're out of milk. But honestly, you know, as we get more towards Star Trek, you know, we already have the communicator. We all carry one in our pocket. And it's more than a communicator. It's a communicator and a tricorder,
yeah,
all in one. And
a lot more of this than...
You know, so as your refrigerator becomes more like a replicator.
Well, I look forward to the day when they combine 3D printing with your refrigerator. Because that's really going to ultimately be a replicator.
Yeah.
Food replicator,
yeah. It already is
replicator.
A replicator.
My biggest fear as we move closer to Star Trek technology,
yeah,
if you will, and you kind of alluded to it earlier, is the privacy issue. Until we get to the point as a society where we no longer have that fringe element that is interested in hacking everybody.
Okay, so you're never going to get rid of the fringe element in society.
Exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah.
So that one, I don't think that'll ever happen.
I mean, because, you know, when we say the fringe element and we talk about hacking and cracking, because there is a difference if you're in that community.
Sure.
They're frankly a minority. They're actually more like our revolutionary ancestors than they are. But then you have the other fringe element, which are the people who will do anything to gain power and control. So organized crime, organized politicians. Unorganized politicians. Yeah, I mean, see how we brought this all back around to the debates? But you know, that's always going to be an issue. Because what's the saying? Absolute power corrupts? Absolutely. And as people strive for that absolute power, you know, and it becomes the goal as opposed to serving fellow man as your goal.
Well, I think the point there is that we're never going to get, as a society, we're never going to get to the place where widespread technology is going to take over our homes and take over our lives much more than it already has.
Oh, I actually, in some respects, I think if you look at the innovation, so our lives are definitely different than when I graduated high school.
Sure, absolutely.
And even though it started way before that, as we got personal computers and people had access to computational devices and then the internet and that kind of stuff. But 50 years from now, I don't think people's lives will be much different than they are today. Even technology-wise. I mean, things will be
faster,
better, but, you know, and...
When's the last time we had a truly civilization-altering device?
Yeah, you might have a...
Or technological advancement, I should say.
You might have electric cars replace combustion, but that's a whole other issue, and I mean, just let's talk about the fuel industry and their lobby and the... Of course, the electrical car industry and all this other stuff, and you know, and self-driving cars—it's going to be 20 or 30 years before.
And I don't think that's going to fly in this country anyway.
Oh, I think it will. I think we're self-driving. I can't see like, I mean,
there's nothing. This is coming from the guy who waited until his 40th birthday to get his driver's license.
Yeah.
There is nothing like being behind the wheel of your car and going where you want to get.
True. But where I see self-driving cars really take off, and this is where it will overturn a marketplace, and it'll be interesting when it does, because Uber's already going. This is why Uber's interested in self-driving cars, is no Uber drivers, no taxi drivers. You go in, you deal with a machine. There's nobody to rob. You pay it electronically.
Ultimately, this sort of thing becomes Skynet.
It can be, yes, because the government can come in and they could go, well, you're not going where you're going, you're going here to this detention center or this, yeah.
Well, and it's not just, that brings up an interesting point too, because it's not just the fringe element in the hacking and cracking community, it's government has that ability too.
Yeah.
And I think that's, Americans will only tolerate so much of that.
Well, I agree. I think we will see self-driving cars happen. I think we will see them mostly in very large congested cities. And I think at least you might have a few people who have, you know, who have always wanted to have Kit for Knight Rider and have that experience of just being chauffeured around. But I think largely what you're going to see it is, and I'm going to use Silicon Valley as a good example, where, you know, today we already have companies like Google and Apple, and they go and they pick up their people, and they, you know, in buses that have Wi-Fi, and their people work going to work and coming home, so they're, you know, they have more productive hours in the day, and you know, they provide that transportation. One, because it gets them to work faster and they don't have to provide a whole lot of parking. But I don't see it. I don't see it flying in places like here in southern Ohio. Things are too geographically dispersed. Our cities are not really all that dense. You know, even the big cities are not all that dense. I don't think there's one city. Maybe Columbus might have it as a novelty, but I can't see even Cleveland having it. You know, and there's other issues with that too. You know, what about the taxi driving industry? When I ride in taxis, which is not around here, but I have ridden them in Alabama and stuff. But the majority of people who drive taxis are are foreign-born citizens who, you know, it's a job they can do. It gives them a measure of liberty on their own because they kind of control their own schedule and things like that. And, you know, that's really where it looks like the industry is poised to take, to remove jobs from the market is right there in that personal services industry. You know. So I don't have to pay a driver. I can drive that car all night long and all day long. You know, just bring it in occasionally for maintenance. You know, and then they're taking, so not paying taxes. So right now we have all kinds of, because they drive fossil fuel cars, there's a, they, you know, there's taxes that they pay for both EPA, which most people don't realize they're paying EPA tax as part of their gas bill. But then there's also a break if you have an electric vehicle or a hybrid vehicle. So tax breaks by the federal government and many state governments. So all of a sudden I go to an electric self-driving vehicle and I'm not paying taxes anymore.
And then suddenly Hillary is yelling at you because you're not paying taxes.
Yeah. Now, I guess we'll close on this since we brought up taxes. So, and this stuff is published, so you can easily go out and check your facts on this. But the Donald Trump's tax plan actually puts more money. If you're making about $60,000 a year, it puts about $400 a month more in your paycheck home. Hillary's tax plan takes another 100 or 200 away per month. It's 100. I think it's 100 per pay period. But the even bigger thing is the, so let's talk about redistribution of wealth. So your parents amass not even a small fortune. You know, by the time they retire and what's left over, the value of the home that they live in and all that. So say they have, you know, $500,000 in assets between both parents. But not, well, we won't even say that. We'll say they have $250,000 in assets. So Hillary's tax, today, if your inheritance tax is about 30% of that value. So you're going to automatically, out of $250,000, you're going to lose about $75,000. And during the Junior Bush, he suspended the inheritance tax, which was phenomenal. That meant nobody paid anything on what your parents already paid in, which was taxed. And it was actually double taxed because they was taxed when they paid it into their retirement, and it was taxed again as retirement income when they started using it. Under Hillary's plan, she wants to take another 50% on top of that. So you lose $250,000, take $75,000 away. So now you're at $175,000, and then she wants half of that as inheritance tax. That's robbery. Because it's already been taxed multiple times.
Wayne, that kind of brings us to the loss of the American dream.
Yeah, very much so.
I mean, it's the whole thing about the American dream is that your kids will be doing better than you are.
Yes.
You know, and you want to help them out to get there. So it's not a, when government steps in and tries to take their fair share of that, what have they done? What's the government really done?
Absolutely.
What have they produced? Not a damn thing.
Well, you know, and that's the thing is no government in the world manages money well. And part of that is because in some respects there's very little accountability for how money is spent. And they view money, I know the American government, I've worked for the government my entire adult life. They view tax money as a renewable resource, just like we would view trees or water or You know, it's a renewable resource.
There's reasons why Congress has to do those stupid continuing resolutions for the
debt ceiling.
Yeah.
It's because they keep printing money and
they don't care.
Well, the other issue too is you have a large number of people who are making business decisions, you know, as in how money is spent, how budgets are created, and all of this, who have no background or capability of really doing it.
Which, as a representative of the people, I don't have a... I'm not one of those people who believes that there should be a political class that is... That's their job and their... Anybody can do it.
Yeah.
The problem is that these guys have become so self-absorbed that they think they know it all.
I'm not even talking about elected officials.
Oh, the bureaucracy's even worse.
It's the bureaucracy where a lot of these decisions are made. And
those are appointed or hired positions.
And, you know, I mean, a good example is, and, you know, don't get me wrong, I want people to succeed. I want people to... If you take an entry-level job in the government, there should be a career path where you can, you know, work your way up. But I've seen too many times where, you know, a secretary with no college education comes in and she, through the years, gets a bogus degree through a unaccredited community college or university through the government, which kills me, and then is in a position to... you know, command $4 or $5 million budget and decide how it's spent. And unfortunately,
I've watched too many times where they spend it like they spend on the home shopping network.
The other thing that's got to happen is there cannot be penalties for turning money back in. Right now, the way the government works, if you have excess money you didn't spend last year, they penalize you by slashing your budget next year because you must have had too much money. And nobody wants that. So there, it just like the whole thing where Donald Trump is actually being smart about not paying any federal taxes, these guys are not losing any of their budget because they're doing what they can to keep it. Because,
And not only that, but expand the budget.
Exactly.
So many of those things that we're now at the point where we consider maintaining the same level of funding from year to year as a cut.
I know.
So if XYZ program doesn't get an increase in funding, media, and I'm going to go ahead and say Democrats too, consider that a cut.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that is difficult, and this is one of the things that we're starting to see the government... both the federal and state and local governments have issues with is there's so much regulation about doing business with them.
And the current acquisition, particularly the federal acquisition program, needs a complete overhaul because it's not, you know, they make decisions based on these generic requirements and then we spend money and buy solutions, and it can be anything from an IT solution, computers and servers and applications to warfighters. And at the end of the day, because the requirements were generic and we went with best price as opposed to best value, we have something that either doesn't work well or it doesn't work at all. And we spent billions of dollars on it. God forbid that one company has a solution and nobody else competes with them in the market on that. Well, that happens. Because that's what innovation is about. There's always going to be one company who has the solution before anybody else. And so you make sole source justification for that kind of technologies or buying decisions so hard that a lot of companies give up. You know, even our federal integrators are no bidding services contracts and things because
just to get the certifications to be able to bid cost more than 20% of the value of the contract. Well, you know,
the rule of thumb is when you're doing capture management is 2 to 3% of the value of the contract. So if it's a $100 million contract, you're gonna spend what? You can spend $2 to $3 million, but if that contract's $1 million, you can spend $20K to $30K.
And that's it.
And that's it. And there's a lot more $1 million contracts than there are $100 million contracts. Well, we're not gonna fix this today.
No.
Although as an engineer, it really bugs me that I can't.
But then what would we have to talk about next time?
I know. So I think we will wrap it up at this point. And we want to hear from you, so please send us some email or audio mail or video mail to gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. And we'll see you on the digital flip side.
You've been listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.